Welcome.
Hello once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me here on this Wednesday, March 28th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so, as we go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Glad to have you with me here for this midweek edition of the show. One guest coming your way on the program today. That is the great Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter. We're going to chat college basketball, Final Four, NIT, CBI, CIT. And we'll do the same thing that I've been doing with my guests here this week, sort of reviewing the season that he had, talking about what worked really well for him, what didn't work so well for him, and what he'll look to incorporate as we go forward here from a college basketball standpoint. Second part of that segment there with Wes, we'll chat about two golf events here. We'll do the Houston Open, which is starting on Thursday, and then the Masters at Augusta National beginning next Thursday, the first major of the PGA Tour season. Really looking forward to breaking down those two tournaments here today with Wes. Then to wrap up the show with about 15 or 20 minutes or so left, I'll talk about my handicapping process for Major League Baseball. Tomorrow is opening day. I'll have my picks analysis piece up over at bangthebook.com bright and early in the morning with a lot of day games going on. But I'll walk you through some of the stats that I look for, some of the other things that I have under consideration when I'm handicapping baseball. Over at bangthebook.com, lots of great stuff going on. You can still download my MLB betting guide. Still plenty of shelf life there with that. Not just with opening day tomorrow, but obviously as we go throughout the season here, the early part of the year, I wrote about a lot of individual players, some things that you want to look for with some of these teams. So make sure that you check that out over there at the website. Also, daily NBA, NHL, college basketball. We also have golf, UFC, soccer, NASCAR. I'll have two NASCAR previews coming up here today for you. So lots of things going on over there at the website where we are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. Check out our free pick contests, our sportsbook reviews where you can win cash, or our free pick contests where you can win cash prizes, our sportsbook reviews where you can see some of the exclusive promo codes that are out there from our affiliates in the sports betting industry, our matchup data section, free pick videos, so much stuff going on over there. It's got me tongue-tied here to start things off for today's show. But make sure you head on over to bangthebook.com and check out everything that we have to offer. One guest coming your way on the program here today. That is the great Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds, the number one on Twitter. Wes, how's it going today, man?
Hi, Adam. Doing all right, man. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Appreciate your time here, as always. Thank you for joining us on the show. And, man, college basketball season, it's hard to believe that it's actually winding down now. We've got six lined games left. We have as many as seven games possible with San Francisco, North Texas. And then, of course, the eighth game would be the national championship game here coming up on Monday. So, you know, as we sort of take a look back here at your college basketball season, we're going to go ahead and start with this. What do you feel like worked really well for you here this year? Maybe something that's worked for you over the last several years, or something that you incorporated a little bit more here this season?
I think probably what worked for me a little bit better was doing, the first half, especially liking some of the underdogs more in the first halves. It didn't go as well in years past where, you know, it seems like I hit a lot more of the first half end game if I was playing, especially if I was playing a dog. But this year it was a lot more splitting. I mean, in the past, you know, it was almost like if I covered the first half, I got the game too. But there were a lot of situations this year where, I might have covered the first half, but I didn't cover the game. Or I covered the game, but I didn't cover the first half. So, I mean, it was just kind of a little bit of a weird pattern in certain games. I mean, I would have to run through the numbers to see, you know, how many. But, little things like that. I think looking at some of these different rule changes in the postseason, I do like the NIT rules a lot better with the resetting of the fouls. And I hope I hope going forward that they go to quarters in college basketball. And I always was kind of resistant to that, but I think it's a good thing to do. I think it's good that they reset the fouls after every 10 minutes. So, you know, I hope that they take some of these experimental changes that they've used for the NIT and adopt them going forward.
One of the things that I'm kind of curious about here is, you know, we've talked a lot about derivative betting here this season. I've talked about how I think that, realistically speaking, that's the way to go. I mean, live betting can be a bit of a challenge here during March Madness, and it can be a challenge, you know, at any time. But I do think that derivatives are the way to go. And I like that you pointed out that a lot of times, you know, the big underdogs hanging around in the first half, I mean, it makes sense. Over the course of 65, 70 possessions, the better team has an edge over pretty much all 70 of those possessions. But maybe in the first half, it's 30 or 32 possessions. So the, you know, the gap between the favorite and the underdog, probably not as big here in the first half. So my question to you, Wes, you know, this is, you've been doing derivatives for a long time now. It's not like this is your first rodeo with those. Have the books made some adjustments, or are they still kind of doing things the way that they always have?
You know, I think that they have. I think a lot of times it's on the total, and a lot of times when you get a line, you can predict, because usually if they'll put out overnight lines, they're not going to put out first half lines until the next morning or later in the day. So, you know, I think what they do, you know, it's the numbers, I think, per se, are kind of formulaic, where you can kind of say, okay, if a team is a 10-point favorite, they're probably going to be more often than not about -5.5 for the first half. Sometimes they might be 6 if it's a pretty strong favorite or one of your more premium teams that you know are going to get a lot of bets, like a Duke or somebody like that. So sometimes they might bump it up a half a point or a point, where it could be as much as 6 or as much as 6.5 in that first half. But, you know, I do think that they've made a little bit of an adjustment, I guess. I mean, I'm just looking just for an arbitrary example. Saturday, Villanova's 5.5. So you would expect they'd be 3. Most places, and they're 3 some places they're 2.5, so they actually shade a little bit of respect for the underdog there, and I think probably because it's a premium team like Kansas. I think if Villanova was playing you know, someone else that's a less descript opponent, you know, you might see Nova, like, and if it was the same line, you know, you might see Nova solid 3 across the board in the first half, or like a 3.5 or something like that. But, you know, I think the books, I mean, you know, they're wise to it. I just think that the lines probably stay relatively static, because there's a lot of people that will only bet full games and won't look at first halves, or won't even look, and I don't even do this, but first 10 minutes or something like that, or, you know, and then they'll have the various props up, especially for the NCAA tournament games, where the first to 15 points and, you know, different props like that. But I think most bettors aren't betting those, so that's why I think the lines stay relatively static and relatively formulaic.
Yeah, that's something I'll be interested to see as we go forward here, because I think that more people are, you know, becoming interested in the derivative market and are seeing the value in it, you know, much like you do. And it kind of makes me wonder here, because, you know, they'll never get the same handle for a derivative play as they will for a full game play. I mean, it's obviously just not going to happen. But as those handles increase, you know, maybe we do see some adjustments made to those prices. Maybe we see, you know, as you mentioned, it's very formulaic. It's algorithmic. It's, you know, something that can be done by a computer. I sort of wonder if maybe at some point here we do kind of see, you know, traders or risk managers or whatever you want to call them, you know, actually in a defined department for derivatives, for live betting, things of that sort. You know, we'll have to see how the industry continues to evolve, especially, of course, you know, now with legalization possibly going throughout the states. I'm also curious to see, and this is a completely different rabbit hole, but, you know, I'm in Ohio, you're in Indiana, and both of our states kind of starting to figure out what they may want to do when legalization comes up. It sort of makes me wonder, you know, on a state-by-state level, you know, what the derivative market may look like.
Yeah, and I'm interested to see how this plays out in terms of, because I think that there's going to be competition, and one of the things that I've always, you know, felt and always said about this is, you know, if these states get legalization, I mean, you know, just because the jobs, the jobs that are going to be created aren't necessarily in the state of Nevada, which is why I think some have resisted it in within Nevada, that doesn't mean that they're not Nevada jobs, because who are these states that, you know, who are they going to, you know, have contracts with? And it's going to be companies based in Nevada. I mean, William Hill US, South Point, I believe it's called, like, Nevada Sports Wagering. I forget what the company is called that does, like, the South Point and the Rampart app, and then CG Technology. I mean, they're going to hire those folks to come travel to these states to set up their operation, set up the technology, you know, do the training, to train the employees that are having to take these bets at, whether it's at OTBs or at, you know, parimutuel racetracks and places like that, whatever the venues are. I mean, there's going to be competition to get these businesses, to get the business in these states, whether it's in Ohio or Indiana or Kentucky or, you know, Florida or wherever. I mean, so, I mean, I think you're going to see, you know, different books, I think, do it a little bit different ways. Different books have sharper lines. Different books cater to more casual customers. And then plus with the risk managers, I mean, you know, certain ones will shut out guys, or maybe put limits on guys that beat them, you know, on at least a relatively regular basis. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how the different businesses approach it, and then the competition, I guess, for contracts, you know, when this thing eventually happens.
All right, so we talked about some things that kind of worked out for you here, and let's talk about the other side of the coin and look at some things that maybe didn't work as well as you had hoped. Maybe you made a change that wound up not being profitable for you, or maybe there was just something that, you know, you caught up to a little bit late, something like that, because – again, as our listeners know, you always have to be evaluating yourself as a handicapper, always have to be, you know, tracking your bets, looking back at what worked for you, what didn't work for you. So, Wes, as a seasoned veteran here of this industry, I know you've done this for a long time, and all of us are still learning and still progressing. What do you feel like didn't work out as well for you this year?
You know, I think one thing that caught up, and I still think it's a profitable angle long term, but what we've talked about in past discussions, you know, kind of that fat and happy angle I like to play in terms of, you know, where you get that ranked team that's won three or more in a row. And you really only do this, you don't really do this in November and December, because the schedules are so imbalanced. And I mean, some teams are playing easier schedules. Some teams are playing in these big tournaments in Maui and Bahamas where they're getting better competition. So that's why you really only do it January to March. You know, some of these angles didn't work out as well, I think, with some of the premium teams where, you know, fading them wasn't as profitable as maybe in past years, even though there seemed to be a lot of parity and there wasn't really one clear dominant team this year, but some of these favorites or some of these top teams in these conferences, there was such a gap, so it was hard sometimes to get wins against maybe a Villanova or a Duke or somebody like that. So I think what it kind of taught me is maybe that this angle and this theory is still profitable long term, but you don't want to play as many of them just because it qualifies within the parameters. You still have to, I think, also go a little bit deeper and look at the situation. And instead of maybe just, okay, this falls within the parameters, so, you know, I got to play it, so it's automatically a play. Well, sometimes maybe it's not. And then also, we've talked about this in the past too, when you have some of these teams that aren't in the Power 5 or Power 6 conferences that are going to be ranked that fall into those parameters, like a Gonzaga, like a Cincinnati, or, you know, Wichita or St. Mary's, Middle Tennessee this year qualified for that a few times, where it's a little bit harder to play that angle because there's a gap between the top teams, those teams, and really the bottom teams in the conference, where maybe there's not such a gap between, like, a, for example, a Michigan State and a Nebraska or a Penn State, where, you know, there's a huge gap with a Gonzaga and the Loyola Marymount, for example. So you still got to, I think, look at the angle, but combine that and commingle that with kind of the situation that exists. And that, you know, could have eliminated a few losers for me this year.
And I think it's so challenging when you kind of do this year in review thing, because you're talking about 1 year. You know, I mean, you're talking about an angle, the fat and happy angle that's been profitable for you for several years. And obviously you don't want to shelve it. And as you mentioned, you think that it is something that can still be profitable in the future. But, you know, sometimes you have these seasons where things are just weird. I mean, this NCAA tournament is kind of a microcosm of the season as a whole, where, you know, we do have two number one seeds on the right side of the bracket, and who I think went healthy was the best team in the country, bar none, in Villanova. Then you've got a Kansas team that, you know, people were talking about them throughout the year. Well, their defense isn't good enough, and, you know, they may not win the Big 12 this year for the first time in, you know, however long it's been, 14 years, whatever it was. And then they get to the tournament, and they've had some tough games. They've had some nail biters, but they still find themselves there. And then on the other side, you know, you kind of think, okay, maybe this is Virginia's year. This is probably the best offensive team that Tony Bennett has had in a while. They were clear-cut number one defensive team from an efficiency standpoint, and they don't even make it out of the first round. They make history losing to a 16. So you start looking at all these things, and you kind of think to yourself, you know, are the gaps getting smaller? Is the talent pool distributed a little bit more? You know, is this something I need to adjust for next year? Whereas this may just be a one-off type of year. So I think that's the really challenging thing here. And you know, we kind of saw that in college football too, where we were very close to having two-loss teams in the playoff, and we had never had one before. It seems to me like talent is more spread out. Coaching talent is more spread out as well. But, you know, you kind of want to see that be a multi-year trend instead of just, you know, taking it for what it is in 1 year.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's always because we're always looking for the spots, I think, for regression for certain things. But and a perfect example of that was Sunday in the Texas Tech-Villanova game. We know Texas Tech's a really good defensive team, and they played very good defense against Villanova. And Texas Tech, I think, was, like, going into that game, I believe they were third nationally in the KenPom defensive efficiency rankings. So they're playing Villanova, and I wrote up this game, actually. And, you know, Villanova, I think, had hit like 38 threes in the three games in the Big East tournament. And they had hit something like 48 or 47, I can't remember the exact number, in the three games in the NCAA tournament, where it's like, okay, there's regression here. You know, there's bound to be regression here, so the other side could look attractive. Well, the regression came, and Villanova didn't shoot the ball very well and didn't make a ton of threes, and they still won by 12 against a really good Texas Tech team, which easily covered the number of seven and a half, or 6.5, depending on what number you had. So, I mean, sometimes you'll see times where the regression comes, and your thought process is going to be right, but you're not going to cash the ticket. You know, and that's kind of a situation, and part of playing Texas Tech. I mean, I tried to play it as an individual game and not just necessarily use it as a hedge of my Villanova future, because I had a Texas Tech future where, you know, going into the Final Four now, it's a little bit more cut and dry with Villanova. I think pretty much the solid favorite, and they're the only future I have left, where, you know, I'm going to play a little Kansas money line on Saturday as a hedge of that. And I mean, obviously, if Villanova gets Loyola Chicago and they advance and get Loyola, you know, do I go ahead and just let it ride thinking that they're going to be a big solid favorite? But if they get Michigan, I mean, Villanova is going to be favored over every team the remainder of the draw. So, like, if you have a Nova future, this is going to be a little bit more of a straight up hedge, because they're going to be favorites. So it's a lot easier than maybe some of the hedges you might have had to make earlier in the tournament.
And I think you bring up a good point. And, you know, this is something that we talked about on yesterday's show. Tony George said that he had a better year with totals in college basketball than he did with sides. Kyle Hunter always has good years with his college basketball totals. So maybe he doesn't necessarily apply here. But I think that's one of the things that we can maybe focus in on for next season is I think I would suggest to our listeners out there to pay more attention to the totals market. Maybe it's not as sexy. Maybe it's a little bit more difficult of a bet for you to make because you feel like, you know, you're kind of – it's hard to root for an under. I mean, let's be honest. It's very hard to root for an under in any sports market nowadays. But a lot of times that's where the value is. And I think that when you've got – we called it parity or talent distribution or whatever else, you're going to have those games where, you know – I mean, St. John's beat Villanova and Duke in the same week. You know, and St. John's is a team that, you know, didn't even come close to sniffing the tournament. Villanova and Duke, both Elite Eight participants. Villanova, obviously, here in the Final Four as well. So I think when you look for some of those regression angles, like you mentioned there with Villanova, instead of playing the other side, where Texas Tech just had no one to get to the basket, Villanova played great defense of their own in that game, maybe you look to go the totals route instead. Maybe you look for those opportunities over the course of the season to where, yeah, Villanova's not going to shoot 48 or whatever it was percent over the, you know, over the next game, but they're still a very good defensive team. They're still the more talented team. So maybe you look at it from a total standpoint instead of a side standpoint, and maybe that's something to really focus in on for next year. I know you do a lot of stuff with totals, both full game and derivative, and you know, I'm going to assume that you would probably echo my sentiments here.
Yeah, I do, and I think you're dead on there. And I mean, and it's like, you know, anything else with when you look at both totals at a side market, sometimes you get a side, you can get a side winner looking at the total, and you know, and really vice versa, you know, and if you're not sure, I mean, you know, sometimes that'll, you'll look at the number and compare, and you know, that'll kind of, I think, give you the winner, or at least give you a lean one way or the other, to kind of see if you can, you know, figure out a side winner through the totals market or figure out a total winner through the side market. And I mean, you know, and I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's the, you know, with kind of looking a little bit deeper, you look at the, you look at the side number and say, yeah, I think that looks right. But then you dig a little bit deeper and look at the total and say, well, maybe they're giving me a little bit of a clue here looking at this total. So, I mean, that's definitely another way to approach it as well.
I love talking about things like that. I love looking for context clues that are out there in the betting market. You know, if you've got a team that's high scoring, high flying, plays at a quick tempo, then the total looks a little bit low and they're playing somebody that's a slower paced team, maybe a really good defensive team. That's probably a sign. That is a context clue for you in the line to use to your advantage. And no, those aren't always going to win, and nothing is a lock here in this industry, as we know. But when you get some of those indicators and some of those things that sort of push you in a certain direction, the odds makers are doing that by design. You know, they're putting their personal stamp on the game. They're sort of looking for ways to, you know, sort of put themselves in a good position, find those types of things. You can use those to your advantage. So we'll see if we've got any of those here for these games that are coming up. And let's go ahead and talk about Wednesday night real quickly here. Illinois, Chicago, and Liberty, San Francisco, North Texas, Sam Houston State, Northern Colorado, CBI, CIT here tonight, NIT championship game coming up on Thursday. We'll talk about that here in a few minutes. But, you know, I saw this interesting tweet from Matt Holt, the VP over at CG Technology, talking about how the handle for that San Francisco, North Texas game on Monday night was more than double the handle for any NBA game on the board. So, you know, if you think that people don't bet these games, you are sorely mistaken. And do you see any value here in these games tonight, or, you know, have these markets kind of really tightened up now that we're deep in these other tournaments?
I think that they're tight, but I mean, you might be able to find something. I mean, one of the things that I found the other night was in that first CBI, the first of a series of three with San Francisco and North Texas, there was a huge move upward on the total. I think it might have opened at like 140 and a half and ended up at 146. And first half, they scored, I believe, 76 points. It was San Francisco 46 to 30. Well, then all of a sudden they put out that second half total and it's 78.5. So now you're getting 154.5 for an adjusted game total. And I mean, it wasn't even a game that, you know, I was really interested in playing. I couldn't figure out anything. But then I looked at the second half. I'm like, well, I'm getting a 14-point number on a total from the opening. And it was a, you know, considered, I mean, you're up 16 at the half. It's probably a blowout. And so I played the under in that. And I was amazed that it didn't even come close. I forget what the final score was, but I think North Texas was, I don't even think they broke 60 for the game. And this is a team that has, that had scored 90 points plus in three straight games. And then all of a sudden they didn't. So, you know, looking at the total tonight, I'd probably lean to the over that. I mean, because you had that much of a disparate result in the first game. And I know in championship games, we tend to want to play unders, because a lot of times these teams are playing games in consecutive days and whatnot. So, I mean, that stands to logic that you would do that. But, you know, I may look a little bit at the over here, and I haven't played it, but, you know, even though this is practically an elimination game for North Texas and, you know, San Francisco could clinch the CPI championship if they win here. So, but I think you had such a disparate result that, you know, you might actually have a little bit of value in the over in that game. In the CIT, I haven't really made a decision on those games. I may look tonight as we go later in the day. But I think these games definitely, I mean, are taking action and they're relevant games. I mean, you know, I always say if there's a line on it, it's a relevant game. It doesn't matter if the teams are great or if the teams are bad. But I mean, what I found personally for this postseason to me, I've done better in the NCAA tournament than I have, you know, both the men's and the women's tournament, than I've done in some of these other games in terms of the CIT and the CBI and NIT. And, you know, but I've had seasons, you never want to overreact, because I've had seasons where I would kill those tournaments and do really well and then not really do as great in the NCAA tournament. So, I mean, you know, different years are different years. And like you were saying earlier, you don't want to totally overreact to like a one-year result. I mean, you want to really look at a larger sample size here because, like what I've done in the NCAA tournament this year, I'm going to be a little bit under that. I'm going to be under that on average because it's been a pretty good year. And then I'm going to be over what I've done in the other tournaments most years. So, you know, but these games are definitely relevant. I think you're probably seeing more action on these games because it's been a little bit tough. I mean, I've kind of been just trading money the last two or three weeks in the NBA. You know, one night I'll have a good night and then I'll give it back and then I'll get it back, give it back, because it's tough to deal with the NBA right now because so many of these bad teams are really bad. And you've got these bad teams that are way out of it, like Memphis and Chicago and Atlanta, actually resting players, you know, because of the whole tank philosophy and whatnot. So I think you're seeing bettors kind of get skittish, I think, betting some of these NBA games because it's like, well, these big favorites are covering. I mean, you see even Houston last night against Chicago. Houston, Paul plays, who hadn't played the previous couple games, but Harden misses, Capella misses. Houston's kind of struggled covering against the bad teams at home, whereas, you know, they've gotten up and they've beaten about every other good team in the league at least once. And then Houston, so you see a little bit of money come on the Bulls from 14 to about 13, and then Houston wins by 30. So, I mean, I that's why I think you're seeing more this year in terms of what Matt Holt was saying, more action on these secondary college tournaments because it's so hard to step in front of these big NBA favorites right now with some of these tankapalooza teams not playing their full allotment of guys.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, I'm sure there are some listeners that tune in that would love to hear us talk some more NBA, but it's just, it's not a great market to bet in February and March. I mean, it just isn't. That's just the reality of it, especially in the month of March, where you've got, you know, the after the All-Star break, teams kind of know what they're doing, where they're standing, all that type of thing. It's just, it's a hard market to bet now because you've got so many teams that are just that bad. And I know there are some very smart people out there that will only bet the NBA up until about December or January. And then that's it. They're done with it because they're just not going to deal with the tanking teams and players resting and all that type of thing. So you know, that's why we haven't talked about it too much here on the shows and why we'll just focus on MLB twice a week from here on out starting next week. So Wes, let's go ahead and talk about these final four games real quick. I want to make sure we got some time to hit these two golf events. Loyola, Chicago, and Michigan. Michigan, 5.5-point favorite, depending on where you look here. For the first game at the Alamo Dome in San Antonio, total up from 128 to 129.5. What do you think about this game here as we're about, what, 3 days out?
Yeah, and looking at the Loyola, I actually agree with that total move, that initial move here, because, you know, people will look at it and they will see the tempo with Loyola in the 300s and think, oh, God, how are they going to score? I mean, well, they found a way to score against Nevada and they found a way to score against Kansas State. I mean, they score because their offense is so efficient. And, yeah, they're working a little bit more of a clock, but they're getting really good shots. I mean, I tweeted out last week because I was just kind of looking it up, but I noticed that Loyola at the time was like 15th and 12th respectively, I believe, in 2 and 3 point. I may have inverted the numbers there, but there were only four teams in the country that had a team in the top 15 in both 2 and 3 point field goal shooting, and it was Villanova, obviously, St. Mary's, William & Mary, and Loyola of Chicago. So, I mean, this is a team that shoots the ball well. It's not just that they're a good shooting team. It's that they work for good shots. And, you know, so I can understand and certainly see the move to the over. And we know that Michigan can get hot. Now, you know, they greatly regress because this was the kind of an angle I played. I mean, Michigan should have been out of the tournament in the second round of Houston and then just had some breaks go their way with some missed foul shots by Houston down the stretch that kept them in the game. But Michigan didn't really shoot the ball very well, and they didn't really score the ball very well. So I thought at some point they're going to be able to score the ball well because they're pretty efficient offensively. And then you saw what they did to Texas A&M. They almost got 100 points against a pretty good A&M defense. So people thought, okay, the offense is back. And then against Florida State, it was in the low 60s, high 50s in terms of points. So, you know, it went way back to the other end of the spectrum. So I think maybe it comes back a little bit here. And like you said, in terms of, you know, and I'm a guy that usually will look under before over, it is hard to bet unders in this. And I mean, especially now, when we have the stakes of, okay, it is, you know, a one and done, and, you know, this is the final four, so you always have that risk of a foul fest at the end if it's kind of close. I mean, if you've got an under, you're going to really want it to be under like the Florida State-Michigan game was, where it's like, okay, there's no chance this is going over into the 140s unless there's an overtime. So, you know, I definitely agree with the move to the over. I haven't decided in terms of a spread play. I think 5.5 is a pretty fair line. And, you know, people will think, oh, well, that really looks low. But I, you know, when you have an 11 versus 3 seed, but I think it's a relatively fair line here.
And it's still interesting, too, because you think about this enormous venue here playing at the Alamo Dome, and you have to think it's going to be bad for shooters. And that was the first thing that I thought when I saw this total going up a little bit was, you know, there's got to be a reason why. There has to be something else because, like I said, I mean, I would think stone cold under in the Alamo Dome with what's at stake here, with teams that don't really push the tempo at all. But as you mentioned, Loyola Chicago gets a lot of high-quality shots. And I mentioned this last week, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, something like that, When they were talking about Villanova, no, Villanova takes too many threes. Well, if they're open, shoot the damn ball. You know, I don't. You don't take too many threes if you're taking high quality threes. And so, you know, Villanova takes a lot of threes. They make a lot of threes because they pass the ball around so well. For Loyola Chicago, they're making those open shots because they're creating those open shots. And, you know, as good of a defensive team as Michigan can be, you know, still, it's hard to defend ball movement like that. It's hard for John Beilein to put a whole lot into practice here this week to, you know, defend all of those different shooters that can create some space and then knock down the open shots. And also, too, for Loyola Chicago, I mean, you know, you talk about Cinderella stories like this and maybe the moment getting to be too big for them. It hasn't happened for the Ramblers. I mean, they played their most complete game of the tournament in that last game against Kansas State, basically a wire-to-wire job, leading by double digits for most of it. You know, NBA venues in Dallas and Atlanta haven't fazed them. Maybe the spot isn't too big here for them. Now, I don't know if they win the game necessarily, but you know, there are a lot of reasons to look at this Loyola Chicago team and say, you know what, the only fluky thing about them is the number that they're seeded, because this is a very good team, and it would have been a shame if they lost the Missouri Valley Conference tournament and didn't get a chance to play in this NCAA tournament. So I'm glad that they did, and certainly, you know, there are a lot of reasons to respect the run that they've made.
Yeah, exactly, and I feel the same way, because, I mean, you know, this team is a legit team, and I've somehow been fortunate enough to be on them all four games in this tournament. And, I mean, it's not that I anticipated this deep run coming, but, you know, just the different situations, you know, and I found myself on them all four games. But, I mean, this is a team that did go and beat Florida out of Florida also during December, when Florida looked like they were going to be a dark horse Final Four team. When you watch them in the PK80, you were like, man, this team's really good. And then Loyola goes and beats them. And, I mean, what we were saying about the numbers, I mean, they're fifth in effective field goal percentage. They're over 40% as a team in from three, 11th in the country. They're ninth in the country in two-point. And also what you were saying about Villanova, you know, a lot of these threes that they're getting, I mean, these aren't just like YOLO, you know, lucky shots that they're throwing up that are going in. I mean, they're running good action and, you know, whether it's ball screen action or, you know, just ball movement in general and ball reversal when you try to zone them. I mean, I think a reason why Villanova gets a lot of open threes and shoots 40% as a team, which is 15th in the nation, is because they finish down low. They've got guards that can get to the basket, and they got big guys down low, even though they don't have true post guys, but they've got those guys like Spellman and Pascal, who are only 6'7", 6'8", respectively, but they're 58.8% from two-point range, and that's third best in the country. And I mean, and then you have guards like Brunson and DiVincenzo that can get to the bucket and finish. You know, they have to defend that because you got to defend the rim, obviously. Well, that's going to leave guys open for threes, and they've been knocking them down. So, I mean, with some of that, that's just part of their offense. And when you got a team like Villanova that can do that consistently, it's a lot harder to predict regression because they don't have as much regression. And then when they do regress, like we were talking about earlier, they play great defense and are able to win on that side of the ball.
All right, well, then let's slide across the bracket here. Villanova, we just talked about their offense and how good it is. That seems to me like that's the key for this game for Kansas, is how much can they slow down Villanova? Because we know Kansas is a great offensive team too, top five in offensive efficiency. Got a lot of good looks in that game there against Duke. But they have to stop Villanova at least some of the time. Can they do it as a five-point dog here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know I'm going to take them money line just as a pure hedge, but in terms of an actual opinion on the game, one of the things with Kansas, though, is that they're not very deep. I mean, they pretty much play, you know, they end up playing eight guys, but one of them was D'Souza, who they got at midseason. And you do worry a little bit about the foul trouble because they're bigger than Villanova. I mean, with Azubuki, and Villanova doesn't really have, I think, a pure post player like that. I mean, their tallest guys are 6'8". But
sometimes being smaller can actually be better, I think, in today's game and, you know, get these guys out of position. I mean, and I thought Duke really did actually a poor job, and you don't say that very often about Duke, but they did a poor job, I think, of really getting the ball to Marvin Bagley, because every time he got the ball, he was getting fouled by Kansas's big guy. And, you know, every time they were driving to the rim, Kansas was fouling them. So, I mean, I think Villanova is going to be smart enough to kind of recognize that and use that to their advantage because, you know, these Kansas big guys, I mean, they'll go for blocks and they will foul and they'll get in foul trouble and they'll have to go small, you know, to kind of counteract Villanova. And I think that's really the way Villanova wants to play anyway. And that's the way they've been playing for years. You know, they were kind of, I think, one of the first major programs to kind of, I guess, adopt and go into this small ball thing. So, I mean, I do like Villanova in the game. Like I said, I'll have something on Kansas Moneyline for the hedge. But, I mean, I think Villanova, I felt they were the best team in the tournament going in, even though they weren't the number one overall seed. And, I mean, I have no reason to change that assessment, you know, here in Final Four weekend.
Is Villanova versus Kansas the national championship game? I mean, is you know, Loyola Chicago or Michigan able to beat either one of those teams?
You know, I can't say that it's the ex officio national championship game. I know it looks that way on the surface, but I mean, I never want to disrespect Michigan and John Beilein because that's a team like we saw against Texas A&M that can get real hot. Especially from the three, and they spread the floor. They're a tough team, I think, more so. You know, I don't really want to say that. I mean, I think these are the two best teams left in the draw, clearly, as two number one seeds. But, I mean, I still think, you know, I felt Villanova was the team to beat. I still do. But, you know, I would definitely give the other side more than a puncher's chance. So, at bare minimum, a puncher's chance to win a national championship. So, I don't think this is going to be a cakewalk for Villanova at all.
All right, let's transition over to the golf side of things here. And I apologize; it seems like we're going to run a little bit long here. So, if you got to take off, just let me know, and I totally understand. But let's take a look at the Houston Open here first. This one kind of like the practice round, so to speak, for the Masters. A lot of similarities here between Golf Club of Houston and Augusta National. Ricky Fowler, Justin Rose, co-favorites here, about 10-1. Spieth, Mickelson, 11-1. These numbers coming from Five Dimes. Henrik Stenson, 12-1, and then 25-1 from that point forward. Pretty big field here for this one. Very small field coming up for the Masters in next week. So what do you think here about Houston? What are some tips you can throw out for us?
Well, you know, looking at the course, you know, the greens are big and are pretty big and accessible greens. They're Bermuda, which and they're probably going to be very similar speed to what you're going to find at Augusta. The par fives kind of mimic the sequence that you see on the back nine where there's only one, you know, 13 and 15 where it's the same thing. I mean, it's a relatively easy course. It's a you know, not a lot of rough. I mean, you'll have, I think, more rough at Augusta, and the fairways are relatively wide. So, you know, I looked a little bit down the board this week. This is a little bit of a crapshoot event because you do have some high quality at the top, but when you always have a major the next week, you always wonder if this is being treated as a tune-up. You think guys enter and they really want to win every time they tee it up, and I'm sure that's the case, but you have different motivations, I think. And, I mean, you have guys that are looking for the first win that aren't just going to ignore it for the Masters. And, I mean, and I one guy I went with, he's probably a little too popular this week, but he's played pretty well. Didn't advance out of the match play, but I thought he played pretty solid. Luke List is a guy I went with at 28-1. I wish I was getting a little bit better of a price, but I think
recent form probably knocks that down a little bit to where he should be. Tony Finau is another one I went with in the mid-30s because, you know, he's had a couple good finishes this year. Nondescript record with a 34th and a missed cut, a 42nd here. But he's a guy that should do fairly well on this course because he got long and wide fairways. He's a long and a long hitter. So, you know, he was somebody that, I kind of liked. Benny Ahn kind of went on a hunch here. He's actually never played here before, but has a couple top six finishes over the last couple months. I went with him at about 40 to one. Keegan Bradley was kind of a horse for course type play because even though he missed the cut 2 years ago, he's got four top 15 finishes here in the last 6 years. So, you know, definite horse for course play, and that's why I think a lot of people are also playing Danny Berger. J.B. Holmes, guy played in said 70 to 1, former winner here, also has a second here. So kind of a horse for course play, and, you know, have all of them posted on Twitter. A couple longer shots if you're looking for maybe over 100 to 1 or around that range. Scott Piercy. A couple good finishes here. Paul Dunn, who finished fifth down at the Corrales in the Dominican Republic. So his best finish of the season, Harris English, another guy that finished tied for fifth. I think there were about eight guys tied for fifth in that tournament that kind of come off their best finishes of the year. So maybe there's a little bit of carryover to this tournament. But, you know, don't be afraid to take some longer shots here. We've seen some guys, Jim Herman a couple years ago, Matt Jones in 2014. I mean, you know, you'll have some guys of class this year that have won here at short prices, but you'll see guys in a couple 100 to 1 range. I mean, Jim Herman was 400 to 1 2 years ago. So, you know, don't be afraid to mix in a couple long shots with a couple of those middle prices.
Yeah, and one other thing to look at, and this was something that popped into my mind when you mentioned Keegan Bradley, who's also a guy that I mentioned in my preview over at bangandbook.com, is he's a guy that's not in the Masters field. He has not met any of the criteria to qualify. So if he wins this week, he gets it. And four of the last five winners here at the Houston Open have punched a ticket to the Masters that didn't previously have one. So that may be an angle that you want to look at here a little bit for this one down in Houston. So I'm sure you haven't done all of your handicapping for the Masters yet, but with Tiger Woods playing the way he is, all of the top names in this field, Lefty getting that monkey off his back and picking up a win a few weeks ago, we've got high drama possible at Augusta here this year. Rory the favorite, a little less than 9 to 1 at five dimes right now. Justin Thomas 10 to 1, DJ 11 to 1, same price as Tiger, which is remarkable to think about. Jordan Spieth a little over plus 1,200. Bubba Watson, who's playing very well, just won the match play 15 to 1. This may be the most loaded Masters field that we've had over the last few years.
Yeah, I think it really is, and I think, you know, the Tiger factor has even made it more so. And then a lot of the guys at the top of these prices, most of them have won already this year. Rory's won this year. Justin Thomas has won this year. Dustin Johnson. Tiger's been close. Spieth has not. If I get a little bit better of a price on Spieth, especially north of 15 to 1, I'm probably going to take a chance with him. But you've seen Bubba Watson win, Jason Day. Justin Rose is certainly a guy I would definitely look at. Rahm, I'm not going to bet until I think he really contends in a major, which it's going to happen, but I don't think he's had that chance yet where it's like he contends and he comes short, because usually I think that has to happen for a guy before he wins a major. And but, you know, I'll be looking a little bit, also a little bit down the board. I think you're getting some pretty good players at decent prices here with all of these guys at the top having won. Alex Noren, in anywhere from 35 to 40 to 1, I think is a really good price. Tommy Fleetwood also in that range. You know, I never thought I mean, you don't get Henrik Stenson at 40-1 in a major very often either. So, I mean, you're going to see guys and some of those guys that haven't won a major yet, like the Matt Kuchers at 70-something-1, who always plays well here and is usually on the leaderboard. So you're going to get some good prices. I mean, I think you're probably going to want to end up taking maybe one or two of the favorites. And the ones that kind of stood out to me were maybe Justin Rose at about 14 or 15-1. I think he has the game for this course. I think he's been playing very well lately, just hasn't broken through with the win. But, you know, I'll get into more of these probably as I go over them next week. Since I play week to week, I never get to look too far ahead. But, yeah, I think this is going to be a really interesting tournament, and I think you have a lot of great storylines.
A lot of great stuff here on today's show from Wes Reynolds, at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter. And Wes, I know with your high volume handicapping and the fact that you do all the sports, you've also recently gotten into horses, I think, over the last 12 to 18 months. So I know that you've always got a ton of stuff going on. I really appreciate your time, whether it's just to reach out with a DM or to get you here on the program. You're always very helpful, very approachable. And I certainly thank you for that and for the time we've had on the show. And we'll get a chance to talk to you again over the summer.
Yeah, absolutely, Adam. Thanks a lot, man. I always appreciate being on and rapping and talking with you and the listeners.
All right, Wes. Enjoy your time, man.
Hey, thanks a lot, man. Go Indians.
That's right. Go Tribe. Thank you so much for that. Yeah, opening day starting up here tomorrow. And, you know, I wanted to throw out some things here as I believe overnight lines have actually been posted now for the MLB card, and they have. So, you know, I get the chance now to give you a little bit of a look at some of the things that I'm looking for here. And I will have my picks and analysis piece up over at bangthebook.com every morning of the season here, barring some sort of weird thing or emergency or something like that. I write up a lot of the games that are posted. And what I typically do with that picks analysis piece is I try to get the games where you've got a favorite of minus 140, minus 145 or less. And the reason why is because, you know, I'll talk about big underdogs when they're out there, but a lot of people don't like to go that high with their bankrolls, and I totally understand that. I understand that it can be very difficult to go out there and lay $1.75, $1.90. We got one game up over – we got one game at about $3 here with the Giants and Dodgers for opening day. I get it. I understand that a lot of people just don't have the capacity to do that. And sometimes there are – you know, there is value on a favorite that big. But, you know, it is hard from a bankroll standpoint. So I try to keep it – to those games where the favorites are minus 140, minus 145 or less, I like to look at a lot of short dogs where I feel like I can get some advantages there with that. But as far as what I'm looking at in terms of breaking down the card, you know, price is obviously important here when it comes to baseball. It's a money line sport. You don't have the spread to balance things out. So you do have to look at the money line prices. I think it's very important to do a few different things. For one, understand the money line price and the implied probability. You can find money line to percentage converters out there all over the place. Any sports gambling website, whether it's Weight and Gold, will have one of those. So look for those. And take, here's what I would recommend. Every 5 cents or so, print yourself out a chart. You know, print yourself out. Obviously, we know minus 110 is 52.38%. You know, print yourself out a chart of what every 5 cent increment means from an implied probability standpoint. That's a really good guide for you, because if you see a game where a team is a 60% favorite, you know, and you don't think that they're a 60% favorite, there's probably value in that line. There's probably value in that number. And of course, 60% minus 150. Go to you consult your chart, you know, minus 150, 60%. I don't think they win this game 60% of the time. Or I think they win this game more than 60% of the time. If you get that type of overlay of, you know, 3, 4, 5% something like that, then maybe you want to look to fire on that play. Or maybe you need an overlay bigger than that. Maybe you've got a lower risk profile when it comes to baseball. Maybe you're just starting out a little bit on the baseball side of things. You're trying to get your sea legs with it. Maybe you want a bigger overlay where you think, well, you know, this team's minus 150, but I think they win this game 70% of the time. Make that play. Go ahead and make that play. Trust yourself. Trust your instincts. Second thing I would tell you here is, you know, starting pitchers are very important. And of course, here over the first 3 or 4 starts that these guys have, they're not going out there throwing 100 or 110 pitches. A lot of guys will be pulled in the 80 to 85 range, maybe 90 here for this first start. It's the cliche, but it's a marathon, not a sprint. So in these early games, you have to be aware of the bullpen situations. And overall, now that we see so much more emphasis on relief pitching, you have to be aware of the bullpen situations no matter what. But especially here early on in the season, because when you've got number three, number four, number five starters coming out, if a team has used its primary relievers the first 2 days, they're not going to use them 3 days in a row this early in the season. They'll try to stay away from three and fours as well. So bullpen availability, very, very important here at this time of the year. And, you know, really over the first 6 weeks of the season where teams are just trying to get into the flow of the season, trying to get into the flow of the game. And that's another thing here to keep in mind. And like I said, I won't write too much about, you know, these big favorites and stuff like that. But traditionally speaking, in the first month of the season, underdogs are the way to go. Underdogs have value. Over the course of 162 games, the better teams are going to be at the top of the standings. There's just no doubt about it. But over these first 40 or so games, you know, yeah, there are talent gaps, but everybody's still trying to get assimilated back into the season. Getting back on the road, traveling, being away from families, all that type of stuff. You have to get into that rhythm. You have to get into that routine. And how many times have we seen the Indians or the Cubs or the, not last year, but the Astros or Boston, New York, the Dodgers, the Giants? Every year, there's some team that's going to make the playoffs, that's going to win its division comfortably, that gets out of April at 500 or maybe even less than 500. It happens every single year. You call it a playoff hangover. You can call it expectations. You can call it just trying to get into the flow of the season. Maybe there were some injuries, all these types of different things. But underdogs are the way to go in the month of March and the month of April, because the bad teams are going to be bad, but they're not always bad right away. You know, everyone kind of starts the season with that clean slate. Again, it's a lot of cliches, a lot of bullshit expressions that I don't necessarily believe in. But you know, these are things that do happen in the month of April. You know, you've got teams that know that they're not going anywhere, but they're not going to play like that at the outset of the season. You know, the San Diego Padres, for example, season win total 71.5. They're not a playoff team. It would take something remarkable for them to make the playoffs. But early on in the year, they're not going to play like a 90-loss team or a 100-loss team. Most teams won't. You're going to have a lot of, you know, ups and downs. Win one, lose one, win two, lose two, maybe lose four, win two, stuff like that. You're going to have a lot of these teams early on in the season here that just kind of tread water a little bit, especially the bad ones. So, yeah, sometimes you'll have a team like the Twins a couple of years ago where they just came out and they were god-awful in the month of April and they wound up losing 103 games. Yes, that'll happen from time to time. But a lot of times, underdogs are the profitable way to go in the first month of the season as everybody is on equal ground. They're all trying to get into the flow of the year. And every team has talent. Some teams have a lot more talent than others, but every team has talent. And if you get somebody that gets hot, think about Eric Thames last year for the Brewers. You know, comes over from Korea, you know, winds up setting the world on fire in April. He was absolutely tremendous. Rest of the year, he was good, but not great. You have some of these guys that can get really hot and carry a team for the first month of the season. So underdogs are the way to go here early on in the baseball season. And that probably goes against a lot of what you thought, because you've been doing a lot of preseason handicapping, looking at win totals, futures, all that type of stuff. And you're thinking, oh, you know, these really good teams are going to hit the ground running. Doesn't always work out that way. So look for reasons to play underdogs here early on in the season. Now, as far as some statistics to use to your advantage early on in the year, we have to go off of last year's numbers, obviously, and we have to do that for a while. It takes a pretty long time for a lot of Major League Baseball statistics to become significant enough to give them, you know, a lot of to use them a lot in your handicapping. You really need to get probably about 6 to 8 weeks into the season from a batting standpoint for a lot of these stats to normalize. For pitchers, you know, you're probably talking about 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 starts. It all depends on the statistic. Strikeout percentage and walk percentage, for example, will stabilize much quicker than, you know, things like, BABIP never really stabilizes, but, you know, things like home run to fly ball rate. It takes a long time for that to stabilize. Long time. So when you have some outliers like that, you can certainly look at them and say, okay, this is something that's probably going to go down, but it may take a long time to go down. One of the big things I do with my handicapping is I do a lot of regression analysis handicapping, where I look at statistics that are outliers and where I can use some educated guesses, some probabilities, some projections, things of that sort, to expect these things to come back into a normal range. So, for example, ERA and xFIP. If you've got a pitcher with a high ERA and a low xFIP, he's getting a little bit unlucky. Now, he may not have the best command, but traditionally speaking, when you look at a high ERA and a low xFIP, you can look to a high home run to fly ball rate, a high batting average on balls in play against, BABIP, or a very low left on base percentage. When I see these things, as we start to get to stabilization points throughout the year, I play on those things. Unfortunately, I can't do that early on in the year. So I have to go back to last year. Look for pitchers that maybe had the high ERA to xFIP discrepancy to where maybe they're a little bit undervalued coming into the season. If you've got a starting pitcher that had a 5 ERA but a 380 xFIP, FIP, xFIP, Sierra, these are all good statistics for projecting future performance. Future performance, that's the key there. So you'll have some of these things where maybe a team's defense is really bad or a pitcher gets unlucky with certain sequencing spots, gives up a lot of hits with runners in scoring position, things of that sort. You can find values expecting those guys to regress to the mean early on in the season. So you look for those opportunities, and there's a column over at FanGraphs, E minus F, it's ERA minus FIP. You can sort that. It's under the advanced tab. Look for some of those pitchers that are listed there. Maybe those are guys that you want to look to back here early on in the season because they're going to have some of that positive regression to where the numbers suggest they should have been. So you do that early on in the year. Also, I look for guys that, you know, are maybe in a different ballpark with a different team, with a different catcher. Catcher defense is something that we've been talking about a lot more in the sabermetric community, something that's been, you know, in the spotlight a lot more often than it had been in the past. So if you've got some pitchers that are on some new teams, they have to develop a rapport with that catcher. You know, maybe they've dropped defensively. Maybe you go from a team like the Cubs, who's very good defensively, to a team like the Padres, who's not. I mean, the Padres should be better this year. Just an example, but, you know, these poor defensive teams may hurt these pitchers a little bit. Will it happen in a one-start sample size? Maybe not. Will it happen over the long haul? Yeah, it probably will. So maybe in that pitcher starts, you look to take some overs, or maybe you look to play the opposite side. Again, everything is about probabilities here. You're playing on what you most expect to happen. Nothing is a lock. Everything is subject to volatility and variance, but you play to what you most expect. Pitcher, you know, you got Garrett Cole, for example, who goes from Pittsburgh, the second best pitcher's park in baseball, goes from the National League, where the DH doesn't hit every time through the order, to the American League with the DH, to Houston, much better hitter's park. The Astros do have a good defensive team, but you kind of wonder, you know, will Garrett Cole start out very well being on a better team, you know, having a front office that is very, very statistically inclined? Not to say that Pittsburgh's isn't, with former Indians assistant Neil Huntington, but it's just a different dynamic, a different culture, a different place to be. Does Cole struggle? Because, I mean, this is a kid drafted and developed by the Pirates. It's the only organization he's known. Much different situation now in the American League, in a better ballpark. Or does he thrive? Those are things that you want to look for, things that you want to weigh as you're looking at some of these pitchers that are on different teams. Again, you want to look to probably fade some of those teams that are, you know, flavor of the month types of teams coming into the season. You know, when you've got teams that are expected to do some really good things, to make some really positive strides, I'll use Anaheim as an example. I think Anaheim will be a pretty decent team this year, but they're a minus 130 favorite against Oakland. Oakland is a team I like quite a bit this season. There's a lot of hype about the Angels, you know, with Justin Upton there for a full year, Zach Cozart. You know, they've made some moves here to really strengthen the ball club quite a bit. To me, though, the Angels still have a shaky bullpen, and you know, I like Oakland's bullpen a little bit. So you know, those are the types of things that you want to look for. You want to look to maybe fade some of those teams that are expected to be really good. Look at a spot like tomorrow, for example, Boston and Tampa Bay. You know, not to say that I would play Tampa Bay necessarily. Chris Archer is very, very good. It's a good guy to have going out of the gate against Chris Sale. But everybody's extremely low on Tampa Bay because they traded away some offensive pieces. Traded away Steven Souza, traded away Evan Longoria. People are going to throw this team in the trash. Now, obviously, I don't like their offense very much. But the point I'm making here is that as we go throughout the month of April, you're probably going to get a lot of plus money prices on Tampa Bay, who by the end of the year probably won't be a very good team. But nobody believes in them right now with the lineup that they're going to be putting out there. So maybe there's some value in that. And that's one of the hard things about betting baseball and betting money line sports in general is that sometimes the value is on a team that's going to lose far more often than it's going to win. You know, you got a team that's expected to win 40% of the time. That's a plus 130 type of price. You got the minus 150 money line on the favorite. That team is expected to lose 60% of the time. And that's the thing you have to wrap your head around when it comes to Major League Baseball handicapping is that invariably you're going to have to bet on teams that are going to lose more often than they're going to win in that situation, in that matchup with that line. And that can be very, very difficult for a lot of bettors out there. So I'll try to walk you through that process in written form in my picks analysis piece every day over at bangthebook.com. But I think it's a good starting point here to look at the first set of lines that we've got for opening day on Thursday. All 15 games, 30 teams in action. Should be a great day. But again, if you're new to baseball handicapping, choose your spots carefully early on in the season. And also make sure that you're shopping around for the best prices. Baseball is very important because some books have dime lines. Some books have 20-cent lines. Some books have 5-cent lines. Very, very important for you to be able to shop around for the best prices and find the sports book that works best for you when it comes to baseball, because it is a money line sport, as we know. So, those are the best tips that I can give you here for opening day. Make sure you read my picks analysis piece and my first daily fantasy piece coming up tomorrow over at bangthebook.com. Speaking of tomorrow on Bang the Book Radio, Brad Powers from bradpowersports.com, Rolf Michaels, wagertalk.com. We'll wrap things up for college basketball with them. Also ask them about things that worked and things that didn't for the college basketball season. And then Friday, I will have my first edition of the Bettors Box. It'll be Monday, Thursday, every week going forward, but we'll have one here on Friday to give you some thoughts and sort of break down some of those Friday games in Major League Baseball. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.